love your work. On this show, we help you find success on your own terms. I'm David Cataby. I've been an independent creator for more than 10 years now. I've written a couple best-selling books, Design for Hackers and Now the Heart to Start. If you are new here, welcome. Again, I'm David Cataby. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And I'm very glad to have my friend Manish Sethi back on the show. You first heard Manish way back on episode 13, more than 100 episodes ago. Manish is the founder of Pavlok. And Pavlok started out as a wearable device that shocks you out of breaking bad habits. You may have heard me talk about using Pavlok to break my Facebook habit. It's very effective because being shocked is not pleasant. But what really excites me about what Manish is doing is that he has a much larger mission. He says he wants Pavlok to upgrade humanity. He wants to use technology to change behavior for the better. Now, the ill effects and broken economics of technology is a topic that I've talked about often on this show. I dreamt of a behavioral revolution wherein technology might change behavior for the better instead of for the worse back on episode 21. And I lamented that the economics were broken, something that I debated with Nir Eyal, who is author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. I talked with him back on episode 21. Now, here's where I go on a long aside, and I might sound a little more angry than usual, but I think it's important. So 3 years now after I first wrote about the behavioral revolution, there's starting to be a buzz in the mainstream media about the ill effects of technology. And I think the most recent election and the rise of fake news made people take notice, and they're finally starting to get it. So there was a recent piece in the New York Times called Early Facebook and Google Employees Form Coalition to Fight What They Built, wherein many Silicon Valley elites are featured talking about their union of concerned experts that they call Center for Humane Technology. Now, truthfully, I didn't read the whole article. I think that their mission is noble, but my general understanding of the topic is that they believe that there should be a sort of designer's code of ethics or government intervention, and you know that product designers will somehow magically follow this code of ethics or that the government gets involved. I say this because I've long been familiar with the work of Tristan Harris, who is the founder of the Center for Humane Technology. And Tristan used to be an in-house ethicist at Google. And I did invite Tristan to be on the podcast a couple of years ago. And there was talk of him coming on, but I think it eventually just kind of fell through the cracks for him. And he's obviously had no problem finding more exposure with this New York Times piece. And he was even recently on Sam Harris's podcast. And if you want to, you can listen to that podcast over on Sam Harris's podcast if you want to learn more about what Tristan is about. I don't really have anything to add to that conversation, though I have to say that I was really annoyed that the conversation seemed entirely focused on this idea of ethics, this idea that designers are just going to kind of magically start making products that are better for people. There was no talk of the economic forces that force the hands of tech companies and the people who work at them. And I just believe that ethics can only take you so far. Like, as long as there are big companies that answer to shareholders, what is profitable will be what gets done. The larger an organization becomes, the less you can rely upon the consciences of the individual actors. So I shouldn't be surprised that the Silicon Valley elite are calling attention to themselves over the very problems that they created and coming up with what I think are kind of ham-fisted and short-sighted solutions for these problems. Because after all, those of us with a conscience refuse to do the damage in the first place. Now, I left Silicon Valley more than 10 years ago, and it would be revisionist to say that it was simply because of the damage technology was going to do. I didn't know precisely where technology would lead, but I did know that after being involved in the initial excitement of the Web 2.0 movement, which was all about using technology to connect people, gradually my work in tech started to feel increasingly without purpose nor positive impact, which is something that I talked about more on episode 16, which is entitled Earn It. So if the Silicon Valley elite had been able to detect the vacuousness of the companies they were building, if their hunger for meaning had been stronger than their hunger for wealth, then they wouldn't be in the positions that they are in. And since they ended up in these positions through this blindness, they're coming up with these, what I think are inelegant solutions. So no, I don't think ethics will solve the problems of tech. I think the economics need to be fixed. As long as it is profitable to build products that divide us and affect our emotional and physical health, these are the products that are going to be made. But there is a shining star of hope that has emerged, and to me, that is blockchain technology. Blockchain technology may enable what is good for us to actually become profitable. So I've talked about blockchain technology and its potential to fix these economics. I discussed it with Steemit CEO Ned Scott on episode 46, and I have shared my experiences with earning money from my writing in my Steemit tutorial on episode 110. And by the way, a Bloomberg columnist reached out to me based upon that Steemit tutorial. I was quoted in a Bloomberg article, "Websites that pay users with blockchain aim to disrupt Facebook." And my quote in that article, in case you don't get a chance to read it, "I feel like I'm in the Stone Age when I'm on Facebook or Twitter. They have no value without what you're contributing to them. If Facebook doesn't respond to this, things can change very quickly. They should be very concerned." Now, I explain a little more what I mean by all of that in my Steemit tutorial on episode 110. Just to sum it up, blockchain platforms like Steemit are like a community garden, and Facebook is like digital sharecropping. Now, I know that I think I'm being like a little harsh, and I even detect in myself a little bit of sour grapes or something. There is definitely some value to ethics, and I'm glad that awareness is growing culturally. I just think that much better solutions are right under the noses of these powerful people, and I can't tell you how annoying it is to me that a company like, say, Medium, for example, is holding on to this idea of a subscription model when the blockchain is right there under their noses. So, enter Manish Sethi, and this is why I'm so glad that Manish is in the world. Manish is trying to incentivize good behavior with the blockchain. You can earn volts on the Pavlok mobile app. You can earn those volts for tracking your sleep, doing a gratitude journal, or building pretty much any habit that you wish. And as you'll hear in this conversation, Manish quietly built volts on the blockchain way back in 2014. And his users have been earning volts with no value yet ever since that time. Now, he tells me that volts will actually be released as a cryptocurrency sometime later this year, meaning people could actually earn money building good habits and breaking bad habits, and also that the volts that they have already earned may suddenly become more valuable. It's an attempt to fix the broken economics of technology. It is huge to me, and I think it's extremely exciting, and I cannot wait to see whether it works. Now, I will warn you, this conversation is long and rambly, like this intro, and we interrupt each other a lot. But I love talking with Manish, so I left it mostly unedited. I hope that some of you appreciate the tangents that we go on. Now, one final note before we start. The Heart to Start, my latest book, is now available pretty much everywhere. Now, that includes Google Play, iBooks, Kobo, Barnes & Noble. To see all the options, visit kadavy.net/htswide. That is kadavy.net/htswide. Now, here's Manish Sethi.
All right, I'm here with Manish Sethi in Medellin, in my apartment, in my home.
In your home?
Where I've lived the last 2 years. And so, what are you doing here?
What's up, man? I'm here visiting you right now at the moment.
At the moment. That's why you're in my apartment.
Yeah, doing a podcast. I have a company in Boston, and for about 5 years before I started it, I was a digital nomad. I traveled everywhere, including Medellin twice. Then I went
to
Boston.
Some very cool videos about that.
Thank you.
You doing push-ups on an elephant's back is all I remember.
Yeah, and in Colombia, at the place, there's a mountain really, really close by. And in one of the videos I did push-ups at the top of the mountain, like about to fall off.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. But then I started a company in Boston, which I thought would leave me there for 6 months, ended up being about 4.5 years. And then it got really cold. And then you were on Facebook one day, and I was like, "How's Medellin?" And you were like, "Oh, it's nice. It's warm. Here's the prices of a place." I'm like, "All right." And then I bought a plane ticket and I was flying to Medellin.
Yeah, it was like a 24-hour turnaround or something like that. You asked me the question, and then you were here.
Yeah, Yeah, it's basically last year I flew 40 times and I bought 39 of those tickets within 24 hours. 39 of them were same day tickets.
So you fly by the seat of your pants.
I am a one-way ticket in the moment guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So the company that you're talking about is, of course, Pavlok. And people who are longtime listeners of the podcast already know you and already know about Pavlok. And I talk about it all the time because it helped me start using Facebook in a healthy manner. Basically, I was addicted. It was like scrolling through the news feed against my own will. Mm-hmm. And just shocked myself a couple times and was able to overcome my habit. My bad habit. So, but you have all sorts of new things happening.
Yeah.
With Pavlok. So
yeah,
I want to give an update of, you know, last 2 years. I think it was roughly 2 years ago was the last time that you were on the show.
Okay. So the Pavlok is this product. It's a wearable device and it's a product of our company. And our company's goal is to upgrade humanity. And we're doing that in a bunch of phases over the next 60 years.
Yeah.
But right now, our current phase is to change 10 million habits in the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. And to do that needs more than just a shock. I can help people with some habits using just the shock, specifically breaking bad ones we're very good at, and waking up early we're definitely the best in the world at. But helping people form good habits requires a completely different way of thinking about rewards and punishment, mm-hmm. about operant conditioning and classical conditioning. And so over the last year, more than that, 18 months, we've been building Pavlok 2, which is this. It's a device that is a module that vibrates, beeps, and releases electrical impulses when told to. And it can be worn in a few ways. This is one of them. And the product is designed not just to help you break bad habits, but also help you form good habits. So to give a quick, short primer on this, breaking bad habits is actually quite easy. To break a bad habit, you essentially want to create an aversion and make sure that you catch them whenever they do something bad. So you ever get really drunk on tequila or get sick from some food that you just don't like anymore?
Yeah.
A lot of times people will get sick from a food or drinking too much, and the smell of that food or drink or the look of the location will make them cringe.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's yours?
I guess I didn't think of any right now, but I know that for a long time, bagels, I didn't want to eat bagels because bagels were the last food that I had thrown up.
Yeah, exactly.
For like 12 years. Bagels.
Like you had a habit and then in one night that habit changes.
Yeah.
And it's like tequila.
I loved bagels at that point.
Yeah. And tequila is a common one for college students in America where they'll get too drunk on tequila and then they'll get sick and then they'll never want it again. And when they smell it, they'll feel a little cringe right here.
Hornsby's apple cider would probably be that for me.
Yeah. And what's interesting though is that this is called an aversion. You always feel it right here and you can see it in the brain.
You feel it in your sternum or?
Yeah, like just right in the pit of your stomach.
Yeah.
And it's an aversion. It can be seen in the brain and it can be reproduced or created by using either nausea or electric shock. And so early on in the Pavlok days, we discovered that self-administered electric shock while doing a bad habit led to long-lasting or permanent behavior change. So this is why what you did with Facebook was like a mini version of this. But for people who are trying to quit smoking or quit nail biting, what we do is we have this 5-day audio course where it tells them what to do. It's like, bring the cigarette to your mouth. Zzz. Imagine how bad your breath smells and other people are suffering because of you. Zzz. And you're going to want to put the cigarette down, but you stick through with it for the 5 minutes. Mm. And your brain starts to create a permanent association, a Pavlovian response, associating those two things together. And that's why we have massive success rates on quitting smoking, which is in the 70%+ range of users who get through the 5-day course are smoke-free 6 months later. Nail biting, hair picking, and now we have like bigger drugs. Like we've had a lot of several opiate users, negative thoughts, getting over your ex-girlfriend. A lot of them are about forcing yourself to overdo an action while you add a zap. So breaking a bad habit, we start there. And I always simplify it like this. Like if you are trying to quit smoking and somebody follows you around for the next year, and every time you smoke a cigarette, they just kick it out of your hand. You're not going to smoke anymore. That's just not going to happen. So breaking a bad habit is a kind of problem like that, where you just want to help them build an aversion and then try to monitor them as best you can. But forming a good habit is different. You can't shock somebody into wanting to go to the gym. You can shock them to get them started to go to the gym, but to form a habit, they need a reward to where it becomes more automatic, where it becomes harder to not do the action than to do the action. And I realized very quickly in 2014, when I was thinking about how are we going to solve forming habits, I was like, well, obviously we're going to create a cryptocurrency. Obviously you should earn money for going to the gym, and real cash you have to come up with, but with crypto, you can print it or mine it. So let's build that. But people thought I was insane. Investors didn't believe me. They thought it was nuts. Every time I talked about it to anybody, they were like, blockchain is BS, Bitcoin, what's that? And very quickly this year, it changed. I started building the blockchain anyway in 2014, started building a reward system, a way to build this. I knew it would take several years before the world caught on, but it caught on a lot faster than I thought, because this year it exploded. And so in order to form good habits, you essentially need to add a reward and maintain consistency. And so that doesn't require shock. It's more about creating positive associations and, most importantly, consistency. And so that's what we do now.
Yeah. And I was just listening to our previous conversation earlier today. And I know, like, a couple of years ago, it was so different, because I had maybe recently written a little bit about the behavioral revolution, about the idea that we need to create technology that makes us behave better rather than worse. You could certainly make an argument that a lot of new technologies are making us behave worse. And I was really thinking there was just no solution in sight, because the economics were broken. The way capitalism works, there's no way that it's going to work. But things have changed so much in the last couple of years, because I did, you know, come across the blockchain. I've had the CEO of Steemit on here, Steemit being a cryptocurrency that you earn on a social network, where then all the effort across that network is shared and represented by these little coins and tokens.
It's like a Reddit for crypto, right? Pretty good.
Yeah. So it sounds like with Pavlok, then you could earn tokens, or I've used it a little bit. There's sleep tracking on the app. You earn 75 volts for doing sleep tracking. You earn for doing various things within the app. But then how do those volts maintain value?
Sure. I can talk about that. I think that taking a couple steps back and asking like what's the point of volts? So we call our digital currency, not our crypto, is called volts. It's at this moment, it's like a point system, like Pokemon Gold tokens that you earn for doing healthy habits. But if you take a few steps back and you ask, like, you know, what is the function of money? What is money? Or what are incentives? What's the point? I mean, I'd love to take like 50 steps back and talk about my fucking, you know, the history of money that I always talk about, which I'm happy to swing into in a moment. But is that what you want? Should I go that way? Or should I go like,
it sounds good. I want to go there, but yeah.
Cause if I start answering your question, then it starts getting to it. Cause a lot of people, okay. So I was just listening to a book on my walk here, and it's a book about the creation of the Fed. It's called The Curse of Jekyll Island, or The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yeah.
Which is a great book. And it's about the invention of the Fed and the removal of money from having any concrete value over the last 90 years or so. And
because previously, I'd say the U.S. dollar was gold-backed. Mm-hmm. For every dollar there was, it represented a certain amount of gold that was sitting in the Federal Reserve. Is that right?
Yeah, the government guaranteed that it would redeem your notes for a amount of gold. Mm-hmm. But basically six very rich men in 1930 or 1920, they got together and they went to Jekyll Island, which is this island off the coast of Georgia, and they're all bankers. And they came up with the idea of how can we create a system in which we can generate money out of nothing, and how can we make that thing not owned by the government, but instead owned by a private enterprise, especially owned by banks, and how can we conceal the fact to the world that this is true? And they did that by creating the Federal Reserve, which is a private organization that's not owned by the government, that manufactures the dollar out of nothing. But that's not the point. The point is this: when people start talking about money, their eyes glaze over and they don't want to hear it, because there's a lot of different, first of all, it sounds confusing and seems very confusing because most conversations start in the middle, where the definitions of what money is haven't been settled yet.
Well, we're also deep in the matrix of money.
It's like a religion.
We're also, our behavior has been shaped by money, and it shapes everything around us.
Exactly.
The transaction of that money. As like, well, now it can be, you know, numbers in a database somewhere, and that's your money, and that's changing your behavior. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you think that it's really there. You ask people, where does money come from? They'll say, oh, the government prints it. But the government doesn't print money.
Or like my employer pays it to me.
Yeah, but where's your employer get it from? And where is that? Where it's all stored in this database.
Why do you do stuff for these numbers in a database?
Yeah. And basically, it's like a post-scarcity system that is when we're living in a, or it's a pre-scarcity, it's a scarcity system, and we live in a post-scarcity society. We're in a society where we make more food than we need to feed the whole world. Mm-hmm. We're in a society where everybody who is currently alive, which is 6 billion people, which is already a lot of people, could be eating and hitting, you know, the first two or three levels of Maslow's pyramid with no problem, where there's more houses for sale in Detroit than there are homeless people. It's like things like that just don't make any sense, right? But it does make a lot of sense when you think of money as a scarce resource owned by these unhappy gods who are really greedy, which is us. And it's like, basically, to start from the beginning, looking at us as, okay, for 7 million years, there have been humans. Human species that included hundreds of different human species, Homo erectus, Homo sapiens, all descended from Australopithecus, all living mostly around the same time. A lot of us interacted at the same time. And for 7 million years, for 99% of those years, we never had a group larger than 150 people in one tribe. Every tribe remained around themselves.
They were the Dunbar number.
The Dunbar number. It's an evolved number. And
it's basically that the way that our brains are wired, we have a difficult time keeping track of more relationships than that.
Yeah.
150 people, give or take, in a given. And how is that managed? Because obviously a lot of us know more than 150 people.
Mm-hmm. 150 people that you can have close relationships with. Mm. 150 people that, like, when you try to write down the 100 people closest to you and they get the same answers each time, you're not going to be able to think of much more than 150. And again, yeah, it's like, you know, it's like 7 ± 2. It's like, obviously there's a range, but the range is between 100 and 200. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to maintain close relationships for more than 150 people. Yet somehow in the last 50,000 years, specifically the last 10,000 years, we've grown from a tribe of 150 people to a conglomerate of 7 billion people, all living in the same world, all talking the same, all sharing the same story. What changed? What changed 10,000 years ago, and specifically 50,000 years ago, that completely changed society? Now, again, this is out of 7 million years, just the last 10 to 50,000 years, everything's changed. So about 50,000 years ago, we passed through the cognitive revolution, which is when we first came up with the power of language, the power of story. And when we invented story, the king no longer has to be in the room to still be the king. Story allows us to grow, even if the core asset isn't really there. And there are three stories that shaped humanity, especially since 10,000 years ago, the agricultural revolution. Those three stories are the story of empire. That's what someone tells you is true. That obviously includes kings. It also includes government. It also includes law. But it also includes you better show up to work on time or else you're going to get in trouble. That's a story. It's a story. That's it. If you don't show up to work on time, who cares? The person who told you the story. So the second story is a story of religion, which, you know, obviously is Christianity and animism or whatever. But it's also unfalsifiable beliefs that no matter what you say, I cannot change your opinion. So yeah, like, Christianity is an example of religion, but so is I have to go to college because otherwise I won't be able to get a job. That's a story that you tell yourself. I could never go to Columbia. It's unsafe there. No matter what I say to you, to that person, I'm not going to convince them to go to Columbia. And that's a belief structure that's unfalsifiable. And the third story is the story of money, which is what you believe that other people believe is true, is true. Empire is what they tell you is true, is true. Religion is what you believe is true, is true. And money is what you believe that other people believe is true, is true. So think about it like in the context of us going to a cafe here in Colombia, right? You and I go to a cafe and we order some coffee. This bartender they don't know us or like us. They certainly don't trust us.
We're not in our Dunbar 150. We're not in theirs.
And we're not in theirs, right? So how are we able to have this transaction? How are we able to exchange the coffee? Well, they believe in this note, this picture of this president, and we believe in the note. We do. We believe it exchanges. And therefore, we're able to have a transaction or communication or language exchange without actually speaking the same language. In fact, money is a story of trust. It's decentralized trust that allows you to represent and transact without speaking even the same English language. And that's why it's so powerful, because money is not the thing that splits the world. It's the thing that united the world. It's the virus that connected all the different tribes across the world together into one giant conglomerate being. My favorite example is like during the Crusades, the Pope tells people to go and kill people in Africa to steal these intrinsically worthless gold coins to take back to their country. These gold coins that have very little value except for ornamental, but because of the, but most importantly, these gold coins that they stole and rejoiced, thinking they had won. But these coins had photos and pictures of Muslim caliphates and Arabic script on it. They thought that they were winning and beating the Muslim people, but they were actually spreading that language back to Europe. And so money became this system of trust that didn't require religious beliefs or empire beliefs, and somehow it has won. But what's really interesting and is that as we get closer and closer to today, and specifically from 1971 and 1973, when we got off the gold standard and when we created the first derivatives, which are a type of asset, that's going to cause some big problems in a few years, FYI. We created a new point structure where there actually is no physical fundamental underlying asset anymore. It has become a multiplying exponential system of trust with no central asset. So think about it. How often in the US do you actually use dollars? Probably rarely, mostly credit card. In fact, most transactions are credit card. It's no longer in God we trust. It's in Visa we trust. And that's a big, big shift, because there doesn't have to be any hard asset anymore to represent the money that exists in the world. So I don't know if that answers any of your questions.
I'm interested to hear what you think about the derivatives problem.
Sure.
That you just mentioned.
Well, I wish I could show you the graph, which I can't. Essentially, the amount of money that exists in the world is about $7.3 trillion. That's total cash of all countries in the entire world. I think it's about $3 trillion of it is US dollars. That's less than the assets of the 50 richest people in the world, which means that the 50 richest people in the world have more money than dollars ever printed, which is interesting to think about.
So wait, the 50 richest people in the world have more than all of the money in the world?
All the US money in the world. Slightly under all the money in the world. There's 7.6 trillion and they're worth like 3.5 or 4 trillion.
Okay.
The 50 richest people. But all the money in the world, if you double the amount of like the top 100 richest people probably have more money than everybody in the world. And that's very few people.
More money than everybody else.
No, than all coins printed.
Than all actual physical money that exists in the world. The numbers in the databases of their banks all added up are more than the physical money that exists in the world.
Yes, and this is where we start getting into definitional errors that have caused mass catastrophes these days, or are every single debt crisis you've seen in the last 50 years are caused by misunderstandings of what money really is. And you'll see this very quickly. For example, Mark Zuckerberg is worth $80 billion or so. Could he go buy something tomorrow for $80 billion? Maybe. He could get credit from a bank. But if he tried to withdraw his money in cash, if he started selling his stock in Facebook, right? His net value is measured as his number of shares in Facebook times the price per share at Facebook, right? If he starts to sell those shares, what happens to the price?
The shares price will drop.
Yeah. And if you think about it, the day before Snapchat went public and the day after Snapchat went public, is there really $25 billion more dollars in the world? No. It's an accounting trick. It's a measure that doesn't actually measure what we're trying to measure. If we're trying to measure money as a liquid asset, net worth is just not even in the ballpark. Yet that's how we just put them together.
Well, in the case of, say, Snapchat, then is that basically converting the story into a representation of the value in that story?
All it's saying is that a market cap of an asset is the number of shares available times the price per share. The market sets the price per share. The market, specifically being NASDAQ or New York Stock Exchange, they're the ones who maintain the means to up and to increase and reduce. Obviously, it's set by a free market to an extent. But stocks aren't even close to being an issue as we get deeper into the new sorts of financial assets we get to. The point being, you can't, you know, you just can't add together fractions unless the denominators are the same. You can't add 3/4 and 18/13 together. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah. In the same way, you can't just add the net worth of a person, the cash in hand of a person and the value of their stock. Cause that just, the denominator's wrong. You're missing the liquidity. But that's like the beginning of a problem. You start to multiply that across all markets across the world. There's $76 trillion in stock markets across the world. $7.3 trillion US dollars worth of currency exists. And there's $76 trillion in the stock markets. Then you start adding in debt. That starts to go above $100 trillion. Debt is an asset now. It's a tradable asset by banks. Also by non-banks, but where it gets really bad is when you look at derivatives. So the thing is that most people don't even know what a derivative is. They don't realize that it makes a difference. A derivative is it's a bet upon a bet of a stock. So you say like, a stock in a lot of ways is a bet, right? You're saying, I will put money into the stock with a bet that it will go up in value. A derivative says, I will put a bet upon that bet that I bet that the price will go up at a level, or I give myself like a warrant or a swap. I'll pay you money if you give me the right to buy that back again later on in a few days so you're betting upon bets.
It sounds like an option.
Yeah, an option. An option is a derivative.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
An option. Yeah. A warrant is a derivative. A swap is a derivative. Those are all derivative varieties. And what happens is that, it becomes multiplicative, exponential. As you add those, towards each other, what happens is that people will create funds of those funds and sell them as an index. And so long story short, there's $7 trillion of money in the world. There's 76 trillion of stocks and there's 1.4 quadrillion in derivatives. And it doubles about every 2 years. Hmm. Yeah, it doubles every 2 years. And so when you look at it that way, you start to understand that there's a problem. And that's...
So there's a lot of these representations of value that cannot be realized.
Could never be realized.
Impractical.
If just the 50 richest people went to withdraw their money from the bank, there isn't enough US dollars in the entire world to cover it. Just 50 dudes. Yeah, just two companies. Just two of the top two richest companies went to withdraw their money. If Apple took all their assets back in the US, and I bet any bank would gladly accept $180 billion coming in from Apple... And then they went tomorrow and tried to withdraw that money in cash. There's not enough. Yeah. And so that's kind of the understanding of money. Now, people often
will. So I guess. So yeah. is part of the story there then basically just that supports the idea that money is a story? Because obviously things so far continue to be chugging along.
Yeah.
Even though
it's a great story.
Even though
it's a really good story.
And if it does, and it can keep chugging along if everybody believes the story of this money that doesn't exist.
Yeah. I was reading a book a couple of days ago. I forget what it was. But the person was talking about how, throughout history of humans, basically, people will tell stories all the time and you'll often get a few people to join you and believe in your story, right? But some stories take off and those stories that take off allow the entire world to unite around that story. And it leads to big, massive shifts in the entire societal structures. And I think that money is the greatest story ever told. And so when we look at that though, people often think that I'm saying that the money system's broken or that there's a problem. I never said that there's a problem at all. All I said is that there's a story. And that story is a representation of trust, and that the representation of trust has some fundamental issues should anything occur, right? So there's two ways to look at what's going to happen. One is that we're clearly at some point going to have a similar crisis to the debt crisis of 10 years ago, 2008. That's going to be well worse than the debt crisis of 2008 when the first derivative crisis happens. But the other way to approach that problem is, hey, what if we try to realign the incentive structure in the next few years to fix it? Because look at the other stories. You have religion. Nobody believes in religion like they used to anymore. I don't want to say nobody, of course, but like the majority of Americans, I believe, young Americans don't believe in religion. I don't know if it's
fewer
true.
And fewer and fewer.
Fewer and fewer.
United States.
And 30 years ago, everybody believed in one God.
In the United everybody. States is a far more religious country than anywhere in Europe.
Sure. Yeah, exactly, exactly. And but like 30 or 40 years ago, like if you were at a table and said you didn't believe in God, you were freaking weird, right? Mm-hmm. And then the story besides that is the story of empire, government. Who really believes in government anymore? Like, do we really trust our government that much right now?
Right.
Right. It's very easy to distrust religion. It's very easy to distrust government, but it's really hard to distrust money. Money is that religious story that we all believe in.
I was listening to, was it Yuval?
Right. The Sapiens.
Sapiens, who I think that a lot of what you're talking about is from his book. I was listening to him on, I can't remember which podcast it was, but he was saying, look, you know, when ISIS gains control of Syria, they might like destroy all these things, but they're not going to destroy the money.
Okay, sure.
If there's U.S. dollars, they go into a bank and there's U.S. dollars there with presidents on it, they're not going to destroy that. As much as they want to destroy America, they're not going to destroy this money.
Isn't that interesting?
I found that really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's similar to the Pope and the Crusades, stealing these coins with Muslim caliphates on it. It's very similar, and it's very interesting because it's like that layer of water where the fish can never tell that they're in water. Because in the same way, humans can't understand, like an ISIS person doesn't understand that they're propping up the US dollar by not destroying the US dollar because it doesn't make sense. Because they need the dollar. They believe in the dollar more than they believe in their own thing. They believe in the dollar more than they believe in their own religion. I think that's pretty much what you're saying. And that's interesting, right? So I think that there's a fundamental issue, and getting back to the question that started this path. I believe there's a fundamental problem here is that there is no problem. That's the first part. It just is. The fundamental thing that's interesting or issue here is that we've moved, like money has served a fantastic purpose in the last 200 years, especially. It has grown us from small tribes into a massive, massive futuristic flying to space, like.
Well, a global network. I'm in Colombia. And
you're whining about having to restart a Facebook live.
Yeah. But I can take my US dollars and turn them into Colombian pesos and live life and live stream to people around the world. And
it's incredible.
We're able to participate in that in part because of money or this shared story. And
I would say I would propose that it's not even in part. It's like the majority of is due to this amazing story of money. And money makes a lot of sense when you are in a scarcity society. If you have eggs and I have grain, it makes a lot of sense for us to exchange for a piece of metal that we can trade back and forth. That makes a lot of sense. But when you're in a post-scarcity society, when there's more food around than there are people, yet you're throwing away half of it, money doesn't serve the same purpose. Bartering doesn't work like it used to. You'll see this a lot with like the big weird ads up for millennials, the big hate for millennials where like, they're not just getting a job and sitting in front of a computer. Like they're trying to find meaning. We didn't need meaning when we were younger, like that sort of stuff. Well, that's because we don't understand money the same way that our parents understood money. They were in a very scarcity society and we're in a post-scarcity society where my friends complaining, as they couldn't get a job in 2008 and 2009, complaining about how it's the worst time ever to ever be a graduate from college. It's so hard right now. They whined from their air-conditioned basements of their parents' houses, living in a amazing world, smoking weed that was delivered to them, watching Netflix and pooping on a fucking toilet, like richer than the richest king of even 50 years ago, much less 1,000 years ago, right? The way that what's happened is that compound interest is compound interest. Money makes money and zero stays zero, right? So yeah, as you inject more money into the system, you're going to find a bigger division of rich and poor for sure. But a rising tide raises all ships. And now most people in America have a refrigerator. And that's
worldwide. I don't know how they measure this, but there's fewer people below the poverty line than ever.
Ever. Yeah, exactly. And so getting back to that point, I see this as not a problem, but it's a thing to solve. And actually it's become clear to me what the path is to solve it. And that the problem is that it's not an issue of money or of equality. It's an issue of distribution. There's enough food to go around. We just got to get it to the right people. right? And I don't mean distribution by ships. I mean distribution of capital based on individual achievement and not based on what they tell you you should do. This is why, and so what we're trying to do with Pavlok is to recreate a new incentive system, a currency in which you earn money for doing the habits you set for yourself. The problems we have now are not about a lack of resources. They're about too many resources making us obese, making us unhappy, and making us stay unconnected to humans in regular life. And if we can create a new incentive structure, where the blockchain is a means, it is not a necessary tactic. It is just a thing that is part of the strategy. It allows us to create a point system, which human beings will earn for activities they want themselves to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of money to be made in getting people to do things that aren't so good for them. And why is that?
I think it's because human beings, when we choose a point structure, something that we choose to is worth value, we go all in. And humans start throwing themselves at that point structure. When there's a gold rush, everyone goes and gets to the gold, right? And the ones making money are selling shovels, but the first people who got there got really rich too. And so what I'm trying to get to is that we like, I think if you look around like 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, especially after World War II, we suddenly had an injection of capital. We suddenly had everybody in the workforce had a job. American economy was killing it. And money was valuable. Money was extremely valuable at that time. And what happens is that as money is valuable, people look for ways to make more money. And what do they do? Well, what makes money? You make money by somebody giving you their money when you sell goods and services. So companies go in and they try to exploit. What can they exploit? Well, if you use a little bit of food technology, you can create Doritos. You can create hamburgers.
Well, it's interesting that like, say, an Apple, with the parameters that guide capitalism, it's hard to make money off of an Apple, not an Apple computer, but an Apple, like a physical Apple. You know, you can't brand this Apple so well. I mean, you can start saying, oh, it's organic, or we don't use pesticides to grow it, or it's from this place where the soil's great and the apples taste great. But an Apple is kind of still an Apple. Mm-hmm. But a fruit roll-up, you know, you can give something a name, you can have cartoon characters. Mm-hmm. Explaining it, you can put it in a box that packs nicely with other fruit roll-ups, and suddenly you're making more money than you could possibly make selling apples because of the way that capitalism works and because of the incentive structure.
Yeah, and there's also like a finite level to form an apple, right? Like you need to have a field, you need a physical land, you need to have people to pick that those apples, you have a distribution facility, you have a lot of issues to solve to get apples from the ground to people's houses. But what if you have a fruit roll-up factory that has a slightly higher markup than an apple, and you just buy somebody else's apples, you just melt it all together into a machine, and then the machine prints out fruit roll-ups.
Easy to ship. They don't, you can put...
they last forever.
You can put preservatives in them, so they're going to last. They're not going to bruise. You don't have to come up with all these ways to to not.
Yeah, and what I found to be very, very consistent with most companies is that the founders when they start a company that makes a big difference. I'm thinking in my mind of innovative companies like technology companies, and that's not what I'm trying to talk about right now. I'm trying to talk about the founders of like General Mills or the founders of Sears, right? Like these guys they're regular dudes who see a problem in the world and then they want to solve that problem and they want to solve it more than they want the money. The money is a means of a point system to and a means of capital to grow. But it's not the end all be all. They're trying to solve this problem. But what they often have to do is they have to hire people around them. And especially when they go on Wall Street, you're surrounded by people who only look at the cash. So what happens is that you have a CEO, someone like Steve Jobs, innovative, idea-driven CEO who cares more about product than he cares about money. And he surrounds himself with people who care about money and people who are finishers and not idea people, but just driven by a point system because he has to. And then what happens when he dies is that the people who take over are the point system, finisher, money-driven people. And that companies will quickly make more money rapidly, making it look like the company is doing a very good job, but they've lost that actual fundamental asset of innovation or idea driven. And so what I'm getting at is I don't know who founded the company that started fruit roll-ups. I don't know their entire story, but I would propose that the person thought that he could help a lot of people by providing a better source of calories and food. And I think that's a very, very good mission. And he does it. And then as soon as he dies, someone's like, yo, what if we just stopped doing the healthy foods and just focused on the ones that have higher profit margins? We can sell off the ones that aren't very profitable. And what happens is that you get a very large compounding, give calories that are addictive because they get return for money process that occurs.
There's a little bit of an irony to it too, because if money is supposed to represent these abstract values, and then suddenly the pursuit of money becomes the thing that you're going for, and the money is supposed to represent something that is that we agree is valuable, then there's something perverse about that. I don't really know how to put my finger on it.
I call that the proximal objective fallacy. I wish I had my bag over there because I have a picture of it. But essentially, if you imagine a graph, right? And you say, okay, here's a graph. And my goal is to solve this problem. There's the problem, right? And so here's a graph. And so what do you do? Well, you're like, well, I will do and create products and services that help us get towards that goal. And what is the only metric that companies are allowed to think of? Money, right? So we're like, okay, let's sell goods and services that get us towards that metric. And the first year, they actually get pretty close. They get closer. And then year two, they get closer too. And they're like, hey, we're actually approaching to our objective. And then year three, they get closer. And they're like, oh, this is great. We can go public or whatever it is. But then by this point, they have too many people, often more than 150 employees. And they can't pivot anymore. They're stuck. So now they want to get close to that goal. Well, year four, they're actually getting farther away. Year five, they're getting farther away.
So are you saying then that after the Dunbar number, after 150, in order to operate as a unit, they have to start relying more on money than they do on...
No. I'm saying that they chose money as the objective because it brought them closer to their real objective, but eventually it gets them farther away.
Okay.
Once they're locked into the habits.
Right, because they used money as their metric, even though they might have had noble
aspirations,
aspirations or things, values that they were trying to pursue, that then becomes the metric by which they're measuring everything. It becomes money, and then they get off course.
Yeah, and one of the scariest things I read was when I was building my business was that if you look at Fortune 500 companies, there are zero companies that have identical organization charts. They all have their own little way of approaching organization charts. But the one thing they have in common is that after going public, zero of them ever changed their organizational chart. It always stayed the same. And that's a big, big issue, because once you get locked into something, you cannot adapt anymore. And that becomes a problem.
Was it you that was telling me that in 50 years, Facebook won't exist?
Yeah.
Apple won't exist. All these companies won't exist, possibly in part because they get into this complacency or stagnation, or they have all these complex systems working that there's just too much at stake for them to break free of that and try something different, because they have maybe shareholders to please.
Mm-hmm. I didn't say that the first time. I read it online in an article, and I told you about it because this one futurist guy had said that, like, if you look back in past, like, there's only like a handful of companies that have existed for over 40 years already on the stock exchange. Very, very few. And that now that things are speeding up so fast that he thinks it's extremely unlikely, almost nil, that Facebook, Google, Amazon, Netflix will still be around in 40 years. And I think you can see this really clearly with Apple. Like, Apple comes out with iPhone 10, and like, this is the iPhone 8. And like, doesn't this look more or less identical to like every single phone ever made in the last 10 years? Like, everything's a little rectangle, a little black rectangle. And, you know, Jobs would not have let that happen. He wouldn't be doing
that. Yeah, you don't think so?
No,
he
already came up with the iPad.
Like, they achieved like the platonic ideal.
I don't think they achieved the platonic ideal of phones. No, I do not think so whatsoever. Not even a little bit. Like, already I showed you, like, I'm trying to build a phone on the back of a phone to give you a second screen. This doesn't hurt your platonic ideal of a phone, but it gives you a second phone or a second layer or extra information, and it's already better, in my opinion. But that's not the point. The point is, Apple comes out the iPhone 10 that looks exactly like an iPhone 3G and says, this is the future of Apple. This is the future of our company. I think that's a very clear indication of what happens when you move from innovative product CEO to CFO style, COO style, execution person mm-hmm. running, being at the helm. Cause like, imagine I were to Apple, right? And I go up to Steve Jobs and I'm like, hey, I have a really good idea. What if we took a phone, created a battery pack that you could put on the back of the phone that would add a second layer? Like, I think I could easily see Jobs saying, oh, that's interesting. And I could definitely not see Cook saying that. You know what I mean? He would be locked in. No, that's not going to be working for a profit margin, especially if we drop the price on the back of the screen. That's going to.
He's an operations guy.
He's an operations guy following a metric.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. I am so thrilled to have Skillshare back as a sponsor of Love Your Work. I know that you will love Skillshare because you are a Love Your Work listener, and Love Your Work listeners love to learn. Skillshare is an online learning platform with over 18,000 classes in business, marketing, entrepreneurship, technology, much, much more. A class that I personally really enjoyed is called Real Productivity, Create Your Ideal Week with Skillshare founder and CEO, Michael Karjanapakorn. And Michael has an impressive command over managing his time and mental energy.
If you look at my calendar, you'll see that it's color-coded. So anything that's in gray are recurring meetings. Anything yellow is a signal that anyone could put a meeting in that time block. Anything in red are like tasks or things that I do on a day-by-day basis.
Join the millions of students already on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. 99 cents, you can't buy a decent pen for 99 cents. Anyway, that is right. Skillshare is offering Love Your Work listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 18,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork. Again, go to skillshare.com/loveyourwork to start your 2 months now.
I've been reading a book recently, The Complacent Class, Tyler Cowen. Really interesting. He's a great thinker, great economist, has some great books. There was an idea that he was bringing up. He was talking about how GDP growth has slowed so much in, say, the United States. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that one of the arguments against the idea that GDP is actually slowing, he doesn't seem to agree with this one, but I kind of want to follow up and mm-hmm. learn more about it. He was just saying that consumer surplus has grown so much. And that meaning that the amount of enjoyment that we get for the dollar is so high. And there's these things that we use for free, such as Facebook, et cetera.
Like $7.99 is Netflix.
Yeah, and our enjoyment of that is not calculated in GDP. Now, mm-hmm. he didn't agree with that assessment, but I think that's an interesting thought. It kind of ties in with what you were thinking of, what you were saying about just the standard of living of somebody who is not doing well is much higher than it was for anybody in almost all of history.
Totally. Yeah, I remember during the solar eclipse last year, there was an article that came out that was like, the solar eclipse is going to cause like $2.8 billion in lost productivity over the next over 2 hours because of people won't be focused on their work. And I heard that and I was like, what the fuck are you saying? Like, what does that even mean? Like, what does $2.8 billion of lost productivity mean? And then I thought to myself, I'm like, all right, if you want me to double the American productivity, you're saying that 2 hours of not using your computer or being at work is going to lead to a massive shift. Like, let me double the world's productivity. Okay. Just give me your entire country's focus for 1 hour and I will teach them all keyboard shortcuts. Like, you let me teach people keyboard shortcuts across the country and I guarantee the amount of output that the country can produce will massively increase. Right. But that doesn't seem to make sense intrinsically because we don't have a good way. Our brains can't really wrap our heads around what these big ass numbers mean. What is $2.8 billion in lost productivity because of our GDP?
Well, and estimates like that don't seem to take into account these other things that we know about behavior, such as what's the one where like the amount of time that there is for a project, that's the amount of time that it's going to take you to finish the project?
Yeah, Peter's law, something law. Parkinson's? No, Parkinson's that's law. 80-20, but there's something else.
That was Parkinson's law. You're thinking Pareto.
You're right. Parkinson's law.
So, that's some irrationality in
it's totally true.
In economics, there where
yeah, like I hope my team's not watching, but like I always tell our team it's due on Friday, and I absolutely know there's no chance we'll get it done until Wednesday. But if I say it's due on Wednesday, then they're gonna do it for the next Wednesday or the next Friday. You have to be a, like, I'm very pleasant with my team about missing deadlines, but I set the deadlines to be fast so that they think that, you know, so that there's a way to optimize that. So yeah. they don't get punished for it. Nobody gets punished for it, but they feel like a little bit like they should strive for it. And then it actually happens only a couple of days late, not weeks late.
Well, it's funny because also deadlines, when it comes to creative thinking, deadlines.
Cut it.
Make it difficult to think creatively.
Yeah, for sure. But they make it very good for execution, finishing stuff.
Right.
Like, and yeah, that's a whole different conversation, a whole different podcast about creativity being the opposite of focus. But that's different. But I think that's really important because when you start looking at these things, we're monkeys in suits. That's all that humans really are. We're monkeys in suits telling about how we have these points that we can exchange for other points. Mm-hmm. And when you start talking about like when governments get together, it's like a lot of monkeys who don't know what the real world is like anymore, talking about larger numbers than any monkey's brain could ever comprehend. And they start doing weird things like choosing metrics that you develop in the 1930s. And you think that those same metrics make any sense in the 2010s. It doesn't make any sense. You can't use gross domestic product when you don't have domestic things happening anymore, when every single action causes a reaction across the globe. You can't use a GDP as a metric. Mm. It just doesn't fit. But that's not going to change the stories that we learned that GDP matters in macro econ. We believe in it because the newspaper gives us these little sound bites. And I think that one of the best examples of this is like what happened with Facebook over the last, you know, election period, where we think that more information is going to make us smarter, better, happier, but it's exactly the opposite. It makes it a lot easier to create these bubbles of belief.
It inflames cognitive biases, mm-hmm. the overload of information, and then also the incentive to distract. Like, we need page views. Clicks get us page views. Certain types of headlines get us clicks. It doesn't really matter whether the information is accurate.
Exactly. You just described it in a very beautiful way. And it's like, I said this earlier, and I don't know a better way to describe it than like when human beings pick a metric that's valuable, we slut ourselves out to solve for that metric. Like, just like I said before, if you choose money and then you choose fruit roll-ups, you're going to do anything it takes, forgetting about anything else that matters to get that metric. In the same way, if you believe that the number of Facebook followers you have is the success of your business, you're not going to look at the cash flow. You're only going to focus on getting the number of Facebook fans or Facebook followers. And I wish I had a better term for it, but it's a very important part, I think, of the pendulum swing of humanity, mm-hmm. of somehow like Facebook is good. It is a net good. And it swings that way. And then, oh, it's so bad now. It swings
for every action, there's a reaction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been an interesting thing to see on, say, Steemit, where I've been earning cryptocurrency. I've been earning money off of it. I can feel that the incentives are very different. The way that people behave on the network are very different. But it's a different set of incentives. So, you know, you get people who are trying to game the system. Mm-hmm. Like they've got bots that are upvoting people or leaving comments because they think, oh, I'm going to earn steam. I'm going to earn cryptocurrency this way. I'm going to earn money this way.
Yep.
So I think it'll be interesting to see as those incentives change, how that's going to change behavior, but it's definitely going to be different.
Super different.
Which brings us back to, I think, how we got started in all this, which is Vault.
Yeah.
And so, how could we tie in what we've just talked about into why Vault might be valuable to people?
Live video interrupted?
That's fine.
All right. Should be fine. Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So a lot of this is a lot of theory, a lot of conversation, a lot of concepts. How does this matter or why do I care? And the reason I care is because I think that we can utilize all of these concepts, these cognitive biases, these misunderstandings for good instead of evil. I think that rather than selling fruit roll-ups, we can sell getting to the gym or exercising or talking to your friends. And I think that the way to do so is to create a point structure that has a value against what the dollar is currently. So everything I'm building relies on one fact and one fact alone, that the Vault will have a value. It does not matter what the value is, just that it has a value.
Even if it has no monetary value, there's still
monetary value.
It's just like on Reddit, there's karma.
People will do stuff for it, but you won't get the whole world to use Reddit.
Right.
Because the whole world doesn't care about karma.
Right.
But the whole world cares about money. So that's a big problem that's already been solved for me. So the goal with Vault is to create a, I can't give I don't want to give all the information about this stuff because it's like what we talked about earlier, but it's a multi-generational goal. It won't be solved. What I'm trying to do will not be solved in our lives. I'm trying to build something that will cause reverberations for multiple generations. But specifically, that goal is to unite humanity into a, to unite humanity inside of a video game. More or less, I believe that we can create a revolution and where we believe that the, that, where we basically do things for experience points that are worth other tradable assets. And that those experience points are designed for us to make us happier and create a better world altogether. And Volts become this point system, the first of probably many, in which you unlock it just for simply sticking to goals or commitments that you set for yourself. I think that this has been one of the biggest problems that we've all seen in the past, you know, generation, where we used to be able to do, like, it's a lot easier to write if you sit there. I'm pointing at the corner of Kadavi's house because he works on a laptop with like a white wall in like a dungeon style corner.
There's just a niche that is all blank wall. And that's what I look at for the first couple hours of the day.
Because there's just no distraction, right? It's a lot easier to not use Facebook when there's no computer in your house. It's a lot easier. It's really hard to eat a cookie if you're living in the wilderness when there's no cookie trees. You know what I mean? And I feel like one of the big things that has happened with this last 30...
So, sorry, just to clarify that, what you're saying is that the environment shapes your behavior.
The environment shapes your behavior to a humongous extent, much more than any other factor. And the environment of the last few...
And many of us aren't even aware of what our environment is. Like,
isn't that weird?
When you read things about dietary things and people are like, you know, make sure that you just don't eat things that come in boxes. And I'm thinking, I eat almost nothing that comes in a box. But a lot of people, that's the way they think. Yeah. Is that everything they're eating is prepackaged. It's not the apple, it's the fruit roll-up. Mm-hmm. Because the matrix, our society, the way the capitalism works, mm-hmm. has created these parameters for how things work. And I think it's also, I'm interrupting you, but I just wanted to get into, you're mentioning a video game, and I know that probably can kind of turn some people off, but in many ways we are living.
I think we are living in a video game, but you know that. You know that.
I mean that in a different way.
I know.
Which.
That's a different conversation.
Manish thinks that we're living in a simulation world. But the thing, what I mean by living in a video game is that there are incentives, mm-hmm. and those incentives shape our behavior.
Mm-hmm. And much like evolution, like you can't say like, human being, like it's like incentives influence video games in the same way that video games influence incentives. It's a feedback loop because we are our product of our environment, but we also massively shape our environment, right? And so my point here is that like a lot of the problems or ills or mental health issues, like a lot of the people, like, man, it is so hard to hang out with friends in America these days. Like,
yes.
It's surprisingly awkward to text somebody who you haven't talked to in a while and meet up in person. And it's extremely awkward to make a phone call suddenly.
Yeah, it's like, did you ever see The Kids in the Hall?
Yeah.
That show, there's a skit where the phone is ringing, and this is like the 90s or something. This is a skit where the phone is ringing and he's like, what, are you expecting a call? I'm not expecting a call. Who's expecting a call? And they're freaking out because the phone is ringing and they won't answer it. And it's funny because the joke was nobody acts that way. Nobody's like, who's calling me? People just pick up the phone. That was the joke in the 90s.
Yeah.
That joke worked. But now it's like real life. Like somebody calls, you're like, what? Did somebody die? What's going on? Why are you calling me?
Why are you calling me? I haven't picked my phone in over 8 months. Anyway, and like for real, it's like what you just said is totally weird because for 7 million years of our species, of humans, we didn't have privacy. We didn't have alone time. We also probably didn't have loneliness in the same way that we do today. You put a social animal into a room and you have that social animal able to order food online and watch TV without ever going outside. And suddenly what happens? Well, that social animal becomes less social. And guess what happens? That social animal doesn't feel so happy anymore.
Yeah, it allows us to be like ego pleasure machines. It like allows us to feed our egos as much as we can take some selfies, we get some imaginary points on Instagram. And we don't have to interact with people and have possibly awkward interactions.
But even worse, it's like, even if you want to interact with people, it's hard. Suddenly, it's like you have to go out of your way to have a human conversation now. But what happens if you take away all technology like we had in like the 40s or the 30s or 50s or 60s? And what happens is that you talk to people. Nobody sits in the room alone with nothing to do at all forever.
I have often wondered whenever I've seen somebody on, say, a public bus or something who's 70 or 80 years old, it must have been like the last 10 or 20 years, they must have started wondering like, what the hell is everybody doing? I used to talk to people on the bus I don't want to give the impression that I am imagining this world where people weren't reading newspapers or books or something.
Yeah, people always show that one picture of like everybody's reading a newspaper.
Eventually you run out of something to read.
Yeah, you run out of a newspaper, right? You can only read the whole newspaper.
You got to turn or you need information.
You don't have music in your ears?
Ask directions.
What do you have to ask directions?
You have to ask somebody for directions. Right. You have to ask them what time it is. Maybe you don't have a watch. And
stuff like that is
these aren't little things like this that you can't.
There was no means for in the moment. If you don't have your phone on you and you catch yourself reaching for your pocket whenever there's a moment of boredom, if you don't have technology, you can't do that. And yes, it is a lot nicer in the moment to scratch that itch, right? But what happens if you keep scratching that itch? Well, eventually it develops into a blister.
This is one of the things I like about living in Colombia, actually, which, I mean, I get annoyed all the time, but I know it's ultimately better for me, but people call. People, anything, they call. The things that you could easily text, they will call. If they do text you, it's often, buenos dias, buenas tardes, whatever. And then they're waiting. They're waiting for your response. They're not going to just like tell Switch you the over. Thing. I mean, eventually maybe they do if it takes long enough.
Yeah.
But mostly they're checking to see if you're there because they want to have this interaction with you. And so obviously their behavior is still changing with technology, but I wonder to what extent or how fast. And this is one of these theories that I have about why places like Latin America or Colombia specifically might be at an advantage because the fabric of their society isn't going to be tearing apart to the extent that it is in the United States because
we do seem to jump ahead of curves. The United States seems to shape things and then countries jump on afterwards, which I think is pretty common. And that leads to like, I forget what the term is, but like, it's like the skipping ahead paradox or whatever, where you get like South Korea having faster internet than America. Huh. How did that happen? Well, it's because we laid down the wrong kind of wire the first time and then they learned from our mistakes.
Oh,
and laid
not
down,
the opposite of first mover advantage.
Yeah, the second mover advantage or whatever they call it. So like, for example, I look at Africa as like a perfect spot for Volts to live. Because like the way it's designed is that they never had money, they never had banks, they never had any
ecosystem. They trade cell phone minutes.
They use
right?
cell phone. They buy cell phone. Where you know how you buy minutes at a cell phone place.
Yeah.
You can also buy dollars, and then that dollar is on your wallet. And then when you go to a store, you text them the money, and they receive it. And the money is stored directly on your account with the cell network. And so in the same way, it's like, well, that solves like I'm trying to build a wallet system where your money is stored on your wrist directly, right? And then you can transfer to somebody by just tapping your padlock to their padlock, and now your cash has been distributed.
Apple Pay or something.
Yeah, or like cell phone process that's already solved in Africa because they've waited so long that now they can do that. They have never had to lay down fiber optic wire even because they just started off with 3G.
They're just kind of chilling, seeing how things shape. I mean, that's not probably how it actually happened, but but then
they're like, we got a plan.
When things have been shaped.
Zimbabwe's like, yeah, we know. We're part of this ecosystem.
We're just going to chill for a bit with regular money.
Or like, let's hyperinflate it a little bit. I'm sure it'll have good consequences.
Yeah, but I guess what's fascinating to me, though, is to see what things aren't adopted.
Yeah, that's interesting.
As technology spreads.
That's true.
I don't have any examples of that necessarily.
Like
but
really
I,
good technologies that aren't
but,
adopted?
But there is like, say, Uber here. You order an Uber, they call you.
Yeah, it's annoying.
It's annoying. But
like, I didn't come to your country to have a human interaction.
It's the way the culture works. It's frustrating if your Spanish isn't very good. Even if your Spanish is pretty good, it becomes very difficult because they're trying to explain something to you. LA. Like a very simple interaction can become very, very complicated. And it gets annoying.
Well, like that's the point. You learn language through those interactions.
And then you get in the car, and then they're like, "Where are you going?"
No, he's Uber.
And you're like, "I put the address in the thing." But they're not thinking that way. They want to interact with the person, the face that's getting in the car. Mm-hmm. And
it's hard to step away from being an American because, like, maybe you're different than me after 2 years. I certainly am different after 5 years of being in the U.S. But like, the amount of pleasure I would get from those interactions has massively decreased. Like, I don't want to deal with talking to you in Spanish. Whereas 5 years ago when I was first here, and that might be
you're
age.
Like, hey, I'm excited because.
Yeah. I can have a conversation. Yeah. Hola, ¿cómo estás? ¿Cómo estás? ¿Cómo va? And now it's like, and I, you know, maybe that's age and maybe that's like 5 years of being in America. It's a lot of things.
I think part of it is it takes effort. You have to check yourself every once in a while.
I wanted to check my phone. I was trying to check my Facebook likes.
Yeah, but every once in a while. And that's the thing.
Exactly.
That's the inflamed ego.
Exactly.
That is like, you just have to every once in a while just say, just chill out and just enjoy it and say, oh, this is an opportunity for me to talk to this person.
Yeah. Like, you have to like put it away.
What's life like for a cab driver in Colombia? Or why do they get so mad when we slam the doors? Or how do you know that other cab driver?
Why do they
like,
get so mad when you close the door fast?
Because because the doors are very flimsy. They fall apart. Oh, okay. I've asked one of them.
That's a good
before.
Reason. So Harari, sorry, go ahead.
I just want to explain to listeners that what I'm talking about is that in Colombia, if you get into a cab, oftentimes, especially if you're clearly from the United States or just a foreigner in general, that a lot of cab drivers will reach over as you're closing the door because they are worried that you're going to slam the door because a lot of us
because we all slam the door
because we're used to cars that are a lot heavier
and they also the doors like have that counterweight thing on it in America.
Your door doesn't
close in America unless you push it really hard. At least my cord.
Yeah, you slam it.
You have to because otherwise it doesn't close all the way.
But it's weird because people with regular cars here are kind of the same way.
Yeah.
But you have to close the door very gently, and it's one thing that you learn over time here. And it's another thing where like when I've been living here for 2 years and I go to close the door gently and the cab driver's like, hey, whoa, I'm going to close it gently. And I'm kind of offended. I'm like, hey man, you think I don't know?
I'm part of you.
You think I'm like that fresh off the boat?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know that you don't want me to slam the door. And I'm a little offended, but that's stupid. Why bother?
Yeah, human emotion in general.
Yeah, it's just the ego.
It's the ego.
Inflammation that is fed by avoiding interacting.
Yeah. You were saying one thing, which I thought was, it just reminded me of one point, which was about how there's no point to taking photos or whatever unless you're getting your likes or your ego is driven by likes or a lot of your value or currency or incentives are driven by external likes, essentially. And I think it was really cool in his second book, Homo Deus, by Harari. He talked a lot about basically that humans have had like several religions. There are like only three religions really in the history of humanity. He said his first religion was animism, essentially gods, animals. I'm splitting that into four religions. Animism, which with animals were spirits, etc. Then the second religion was like a monotheistic god of who told you what to do, whose rights and rules were correct. And that really changed with Protestantism, Martin Luther, that although they believed in a god, what really set the stage for was individualism, a religion that persisted for 500 years, where your own inner beliefs are true. What you think is true is true. I'm going to journal so I can identify what the truth is. And that's the religion we grew up with, the religion of that ended in the mid-90s, the religion of individuals have the truth inside of them. And that religion.
Humanism, sort of.
Humanism is what he called it. And that religion has shifted in the last 15, 20 years to dataism, where there is no value in the internal world. The only value is what the machine says is true. So a photo is not worth taking unless it has likes, and the value of that photo is determined by likes. And in the same way, there's no reason to write a story unless you're going to post a blog post about it, because what's the value if in that society where the religion isn't from the internal being anymore? And I thought that was extremely powerful for me because I realized how true it is.
And that's a bit of a problem too, because you can have kind of, I don't know what to call it, data blindness. It's like because you're measuring this thing, you're believing that it's true when in fact maybe your measurement is off, or you're also ignoring other things. There's the post that I've written about. I was really annoyed by the A/B testing obsession that was going on shortly after the Lean Startup, which is a great book that cautions against exactly what we're talking about. But, you know, I ran tests and found that, you could see, this email had 12 clicks. This one had 3 clicks. So the first email must have been better. Yeah, but they were the exact same email.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be happening where you've made one little change and now you're like making all these decisions on something that isn't true. I've also found I've talked about this before, being somebody who has like mysterious health issues, and they often involve multiple complex systems that are working with each other. And so there will be this sort of data bias where somebody will say, well, there's no medical proof that such and such thing works. And there might be a study that goes across a population and this particular thing doesn't work for this population. But then if you dig deeper, you find that, there's some people that this thing works for, and there's some people that this thing doesn't work for. And it's almost like there's this unhealthy obsession or unhealthy fear of being wrong that people have that makes them wrong in a way.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, we might have talked about this, and I've heard it talked about before, or the idea that a politician is a flip-flopper. That somehow that's a
why is that a bad thing?
You had an opinion and maybe you learned a little something new and now you've changed your opinion.
Yep.
And I think that this is something that can really hold us back, is being ashamed of being wrong.
It's really stupid. I'm always confused.
And I think
why people
data inflames it, because it makes us think that we're right even more intensely, and then it makes anybody who deviates from that more wrong and more shameful.
Well, it's also like this unlimited access to data lets you find the data that supports your vision. Like I can find 50 studies that support the ketosis diet, and I can find 50 studies that don't. And guess which ones, when I search for something online, I'm looking for, you know, the ones that support my point. And the more you see, the more you believe, but that doesn't take into account all these other problems with, you know, just the entire study system. But yeah, exactly what you're saying. It's just like, well, there's two forms of what you're saying that I'm hearing. One is that data or A/B testing makes people you're afraid to be wrong. Test everything. Don't make big jumps unless you have data to prove it, which is a weird.
Also, don't connect with your humanity or your art or your point of view, which will help guide your decisions.
Yeah,
it's a whole
the death
thing.
Of humanism and increase of dataism for sure. But I've also seen that people just believe the metrics more than they always should. Our first week that we released sleep tracking on the Pavlok app, I was just trying to get it out. And so I had a few people who were beta testing, and it was like, we didn't have the full code written for the proper data tracking on the sleep cycles. So it was just sort of like, if there's a lot of motion, deep sleep, if there's no motion, light sleep, or vice versa. And, but it wasn't accurate. It was just a test, just to throw the code out. And our beta testers the next day were like, oh, that's so interesting. You know, I had like a terrible sleep. I feel really tired today, but like, you know, I this morning I felt really tired, but then I checked my Pavlok app and it told me I had like 8 hours of deep sleep. So, you know, I guess I slept really well. I'm feeling great today. And I was like, what?
That's funny. Like I feel bad. Like I didn't sleep very well.
Then I saw the data. Yeah.
That I slept well. And so that must mean that I
slept well. And I'm like, dude, do not trust that data. Like, I just wrote that last night. Like, that's not accurate yet. This is just a beta. And it was mind boggling how fast people believe the machine. And that is, you know, an opportunity for both bad actors and good actors. Because if you believe the machine and the machine tells you things that are useful for you to achieve goals that you really do want to achieve, I think that that's where where Pavlok's capability lies and where our opportunity lies. And we have, a pretty counterintuitive, basically, we have a bunch of core values, and one of our core values, the most controversial one of our core values, is that where we are going is more important than how we get there, which is essentially the end justifies the means. And this is definitely one of our most controversial, because when we created this core value, that means that, for example, if you are using our product and your goal is to become happier, and suddenly your Facebook gets delayed or specific posts are hidden from your Facebook feed, and we didn't tell you that we're doing that, that's within our values. Because if we hide all your Trump posts and suddenly you become a happier person, then we don't feel like we've done anything wrong. In fact, we've only done things that are right. And I think that's going to be a continuous problem for us in the future, just on a, you know, that's definitely a controversial ethical way to approach that problem. But that's just my view, where people don't need to know everything.
That reminds me of the ethics of placebo. Mm-hmm. I was reading a book about placebo. Great book, Placebo, Mind Over Matter in Modern Medicine, Dylan Evans, I think is his name. And it really just breaks down what we know and don't know about placebo. We don't know much about placebo, as people like to talk like we know about placebo. But then there's these ethical questions, like if, as they found, you can improve angina symptoms, which is like a heart condition, by doing a sham surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how they got the ethics board passed for the study. They basically opened some people up, closed them back up, didn't perform the surgery,
mm-hmm.
and they did, I don't remember exactly, as well or better. They basically found this sham surgery improved their condition.
Yep.
Versus the people that they gave an actual surgery. And so obviously there's some ethical issues to be had there where if you told somebody, we're going to give you a sham surgery, it doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The placebo doesn't work anymore.
Well, sometimes it does. There's some evidence that shows that even if you tell people about a placebo, it still works. But it doesn't work as well, for sure.
Sometimes, yeah. It doesn't even work as well. That's why they do double-blind studies.
Yeah.
Is that if the practitioner
exactly.
giving the placebo knows it's a placebo,
it has an effect.
It doesn't
because
work
the power
as well.
Is belief. And that's the thing that's crazy. It's like the book The Secret. People either love The Secret or they hate The Secret, but they don't understand that there's an actual, like, I'm not on the side of the pro secret.
Sure.
It'll manifest itself. Obviously, that's not purely true. But to discard belief only for metrics is a stupid point. It's a stupid idea. It's just stupid. It's useless and wrong. Because the idea that, like, for example, if you believe, like, whatever you believe to be, what's a good example?
To me, it reminds me of, I've heard people say, like, oh, you know, I'm not a big wine person, but they took some experts and they gave them glasses of wine in different types of glasses, and they couldn't tell the difference.
Yeah.
And the type of glass that you drink a drink from doesn't matter because of that. And they're forgetting that holding the glass with this certain shape to it, even if it's not affecting the taste, it's changing your experience.
Like,
and so what's
isolate,
so wrong?
We try to isolate.
What's so wrong with having an experience and maybe it's integrated with it, or what's so wrong with believing that?
It's like humans find a need to isolate this one specific chemical that's the thing that causes X to happen. So there was a really cool study that came out of Harvard. So one of the most, the profession of housekeeper at a hotel is an extremely arduous calorie burning, job.
Mm-hmm.
But yet if you look at most housekeepers, you'll find that they're overweight. And so this one woman, at Harvard, this professor, she did a study where she went to a Harvard based hotel and told half of the housekeepers, nothing. And the other half, I think it was 80 people. She told them that when you make one bed, you burn this many calories. When you fluff up this thing, you burn this many calories. And then track their steps, track their activity for about 3 weeks, I believe it was. And then she came back 3 weeks later and, she had measured their heart, their blood pressure, their heart rate, their weight, their, et cetera, body metrics. And the group that was told nothing had no change in activity and had no change in body metrics. And the group that she had told items to had no change in activity, but had massive shifts in their body architecture. They had like a 10% lower blood pressure rate. Their weight had dropped by 5 pounds, and they had done literally nothing new except that they believed that they were being healthy.
Or she told them a thing that they could, that they would then think about as they're performing these actions too.
Yep.
And that possibly had,
but also we don't know exactly what the rule is.
Yeah,
all I truly believe, and I've been thinking about it this week as I've been doing exercise and being healthy this week, it's that your body and your mind are connected. They are connected. It's stupid to believe that they're not connected, because they clearly are. And if you have a belief that, like, when I eat healthy, My version of healthy eating is a paleo keto diet. It's eating a lot of fat, eating a lot of meat. And every time I do it, I lose weight, bar none. It's true. Yet other people's varieties of losing weight is low fat, and eating meat to them is disgusting or against their ethics, right? And I would propose, and I'm not sure, I would propose that if you take a vegan and you say who's overweight and you have them eat the exact same diet as me with meat, that their weight would not decrease at the same levels that mine would. That my belief in, and I've noticed this so clearly, that small little actions like cooking one meal of a keto meal, somehow the next day I find myself upstairs on the roof meditating and swimming. And I didn't even intend to. It's just that like the, it starts like a barrel roll process of small changes, but it doesn't matter what the action. I would even propose that you take somebody who believes that McDonald's is healthy and you have them eat a McDonald's diet. And I'm not saying they'll lose weight, but I'm saying that they won't have as negative effects as somebody who believes it is gross junk food.
Yeah.
Which I think is powerful.
So this ties into, I guess, cognitive biases and say with health stuff. There's complex health problems that are difficult to understand and very impossible to understand across large populations almost. And so because of that, because of the nature of that, something about that attracts people who have poor reasoning skills, who are not able to who don't understand concepts such as regression to the mean, mm-hmm. or
you just take everybody cares about food,
or the importance of being skeptical, mm-hmm. even of your own experiences. And so that in some way can color some of these things that are difficult to understand or difficult for us to say, here is the answer, mm-hmm. Because it attracts people like that. And that almost makes it like more shameful to then be a part of something, whether it's like a diet related way of treating an illness, mm-hmm. or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, what's up with that? Why do they have to be so mean about it? Like, why can't we believe that diet affects our illnesses?
I mean, you'll see people.
So crazy.
Yeah.
People are like, well, you know, the only way to medicate depression is through these medical pills. And yeah, let's not even ask how much you sleep, how much you drink, if you have social interactions with friends, what do you spend your time doing? Do you ever exercise? Mm-hmm. Let's not even ask that because that's not important. Well, it's just take the medicine.
Well, that's the thing is any of those things you're talking about, it can be very easy, especially on an individual basis, to say, oh, you tried that and it worked. Well, that doesn't count because it's not across the pop. Your sample size isn't high enough, et cetera. And so it's very easy to nitpick these things with these very valuable reasoning tools that we have for understanding and advancing medicine as much as we have. And then so because of that, then it becomes
so we
like
created
a taboo. Like you can't kind of go off of your own experience and say like, look,
yeah,
I feel
took keto. Oh, well, keto is fucking unhealthy. Therefore, it can't be working for
I
you.
I mean, what's wrong with saying like, I tried this thing. I feel better. I could be fooling myself.
But who cares?
But I feel better. But who cares?
Who cares? This is an important point.
But it's also, but it's tough.
We're both getting excited.
I understand why it's tricky too, because when it comes to preying on consumers, mm-hmm. and taking advantage of these cognitive shortcomings that everybody has, then it becomes very easy to take people's money. You know, with sham treatments and things like
that. Yeah, and if you see like the Prozac Nation, like the whole story of how depression Prozac started being created is a recipe for unethical focusing on cash flow over the needs of the consumer. Look at the opiate crisis, right? It was created by pharmaceutical companies giving out too much Vicodin and then just removing the amount of Vicodin you can take. And then, well, what do you do if you're addicted to Vicodin you were given by a doctor? Well, you're going to go get heroin. It's going to happen. And so that's like the number one addiction right now the number one addiction, I think it was reported by the CDC in America, is prescription pills, which is something to think about. How is it that the hospital is the one who is creating the worst addiction, killing the most young people in America? Something's wrong there, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why I have to fix it. But well, there's one thing I wanted to get to, and then I think we should wind down. And that was what...
Hey, I got to say when we wind down.
too much.
That's fine.
It's okay. Cut that part out. Nobody heard it. but essentially, I have, okay, so I don't know if you know this, that I'm doing a master's right now at Harvard's Extension School in clinical psychology. Did you know that?
Yes, you did mention that to me.
So I've been
Our
doing-
listeners didn't know that though.
But oh yeah, I forget there's
many people listening to us.
So I'm doing a master's Hopefully. At Harvard's Extension School in clinical psych right now. And I'm doing it with a focus on statistics and dopamine. And so I took a really interesting class on statistics. And long story short, statistics are like, especially in social sciences, are like a farce. It's like some dude in like 1930 came up with the p-value, and now all people do is exploit the p-value, and they don't even know what it means. In fact, in the phenomenon
is called p-hacking, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, p-hacking. And a p-hacking is very relevant to what I'm about to say, which is p-hacking is where a p-value is, you say, if you do a study and then you measure the variances, that if p is less than 0.05, that means that less than 5% of the time, that is due to chance.
Yes.
That means that 95% of the time, that is perfect and that the study is valuable.
One out of 20 times, you get misleading results.
Yeah. So what happens though is when you start to measure more than one thing at a time, so like you measure a lot of variables, like just your Fitbit can measure like 15 or 16 different variables about you, right? Well, what happens is if you look for a p-value that has statistical significance, you're going to find one, especially if there's more than 20 attributes.
There's almost, I
don't know the math on exactly what the percentage chance of you finding one is. But anyway, so what I started to notice though was that there was a lot of interesting, from the stats class, I learned that there's a lot of different ways to compare data. And specifically, there's a lot of very interesting correlational methods to determine data. And so I started feeding it. I wrote a small little machine learning algorithm for our users where we imported a bunch of users' MyFitnessPal data, their smart scale data, and then their Pavlok sleep data. And we wanted to see what items were correlated with them gaining weight and what items were correlated with them losing weight, right? And what we found was fascinating. Whenever we interviewed any of these people, they would give us answers like, I think I lost weight because I ate eggs and olives, or I ate vegetables. And they'd say, I gained weight because I ate pizza or bagels or brownies, right? And yet for the majority of the users, over 90% of the days that they slept over 7 hours a day, they lost weight. And that for the majority of users, the number of days that they slept, every single day that they slept under 7 hours, they gained weight. And that sleep was by far, not even in the same ballpark, the most important factor correlationally to gaining or losing weight. Now, when you look at this data set, and I can show it to you after, it doesn't tell you if they're losing weight because they had fewer hours in the day to eat, or because their sleep improved their willpower in the morning, or because sleep created a hormonal shift. It doesn't say that. All it says is that when you sleep, you gain weight or you lose weight. And when you don't sleep, you gain weight. And when I looked at this, I formulated basically what I imagine will be my thesis. And that is, given enough data, a small amount of data for an individual, correlation is more important than causation. And I think that that's a very, very counterintuitive and what I truly believe is true, important data set for modern technology and modern science. We need to be throwing away across population sample studies and focusing on individual correlational studies because it's way more accurate.
Well, and this is totally one of the tools of the data blind is to say correlation is not causation is something people love to say to show that they're
almost like
smart,
a religious
right.
Almost like a religious chant, like amen, correlation is not causation.
Yeah.
It's almost the same without actually really understanding what that means.
Which I think is an important thing to understand.
By the way, correlation is not causation. It's a very important thing to understand.
I think it's an important thing
Huge.
To understand.
Agreed.
But it's not, doesn't mean it's without value.
Exactly. Correlation is not causation does not mean that correlation does not have value. And especially because when correlation is not causation was a much more important phrase, that was before having the capabilities to measure data. You can't have correlation when you don't have any data. If all I know is one attribute about you, I can't find correlations. P-hacking is finding correlations. I'm saying that P-hacking is not bad if understood and used for good. If I know that you lose weight when you sleep more, for example, we had one user, 100% of the days that they slept, they lost weight. 71.7% of the days that they didn't sleep, they gained weight.
They didn't sleep?
Slept less than 7 hours.
Less than 7 hours.
Yeah. And yet one of the highest rating factors for them losing weight was half and half. The half and half, half creamer, half milk. And I said, what is up with half and half? How would that have anything to do with it? We found out that on days that he took a left on his way to work. He went to Starbucks and he'd have half and half in his coffee. And the days that he didn't take a left and he took a right, he'd go to a diner and have brownies. And that the half and half was a representation of the path he took to work. And that if all he threw away all he cared about with diet, all he cared about with everything else, all he had to do was sleep 7 hours a day and take a left on his way to work, he lost over 20 pounds in 6 weeks. Super simple.
So you ended up implementing that after finding this data? Is that what you're
saying? I told him what to do. I said,
dude. And he did it.
And he did it and he lost weight. And it was very simple. Mostly sleep. Sleep was the big one.
So that's interesting because it's a behavioral thing. I think it's tricky for somebody to say, I'm going to eat less of this or eat more of that.
And no population study would ever find take left on your way to work as a valuable metric.
People who turn left on their way to work. I can see the headline already. People who turn left on their way to work. 6 weeks.
That's exactly right.
I can already see the info.
I can already see the Daily Mail. I can already see it. Exactly. We've got our new diet plan. But when you look at those,
behavioral because it makes the choice so simple. Do this behavior, and you do this behavior, and now when you do the behavior, you've changed your environment.
Yeah, and you also believe
because doing the behavior put him closer to Starbucks.
Yeah,
doing the behavior put him in Starbucks.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also like, but also a lot of it's belief, right? I would fathom that even if that data wasn't actually valid and I said the same thing, it would have contributed to losing weight. Because on your way to the left to lose weight, you're going to be thinking about how you are doing this for this purpose. And then when you get to wherever you're going, you're going to be in the mindset of a healthy dude, not in the mindset of an unhealthy dude. And that will change some interactions, some actions, but it also, I think, will change I don't have any evidence of this, but except for what I told you, the one study about Harvard. But I truly fundamentally believe that if you believe you are a healthy person, you will become on metrics a healthier person. And that is, I think, really important because I really would love to study that deeply. Get like a bunch of kids born and then teach them forever that McDonald's is healthy.
Well, it's like
see what happens.
It's like the hacks that Scott Adams did with himself and looking in the mirror every day and telling himself over and over again that he's going to become a great cartoonist.
Affirmations, yeah.
Affirmations.
Yeah, exactly. And there's so much value to those things. And people make fun of it. And there's like...
Well, they make fun of it because it's easy to find the weapons to make fun of it because of data, right? This is what
And you can't prove...
I'm calling it data blindness, I guess.
You can't prove... There's just something about humans or something about modern American humans from the coast who think they're so smart. That's like... Become a religion, like science has become a religion to the point that if it's in a peer-reviewed clinical trial, it has to be true. And it's not true, even if 50 anecdotal stories say it's true, it's not true unless the cartel of Big Pharma has approved the studies that say it's true. And it's a funny situation.
Well, and actually it ties into this idea that if you think about turning left at work and it's going to make you lose weight. If you think you're smart, you'll continuously make yourself dumber and dumber because you keep thinking you're smart, you keep thinking you're right, and then you stop questioning
exactly
what you believe or what you see, and it just exponentiates your wrongness.
And you
become so smart that you're dumb.
It's such a problem. But yeah, anyway.
Well, I think that we are going to – I think that we've sufficiently convinced many people that we're both insane.
Yeah, also –
some people are going to think that. But
guess what?
Wrong.
You're wrong. We're right.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
There's nobody watching us anymore.
They're all like, fuck these guys. The secret? The hell are they talking about?
All right.
Guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I had a lot of fun.
It was great.
Pavlok.com.
Oh, yeah. Where else can they get you? Pavlok.com.
Yeah, Pavlok.com. Search for shocking device or Pavlok. You'll find it.
Great.
Thanks.
Is Love Your Work helping inspire you to pursue the life and work that you love? If so, I could really use your help. This show takes work and it takes money to make. To keep making the show and to keep it free for everyone, it needs your support. Besides subscribing and reviewing the show, there's one big thing you can do to help, and that is to donate. I work to make this show nourishing and thoughtful in an economy that's all about grabbing attention. This is not the short route to success. If you believe in Love Your Work's message of living a balanced life and finding fulfilling work, please join Love Your Work Elite, hosted on Patreon. Patreon is a platform that lets you support creators like me, vote with your dollars, and keep Love Your Work going. You're going to get bonus content and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at lywelite.com. That's lywelite.com. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by top Love Your Work Elite members, such as Arif Akhtar. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Jirena from the album About Everything and More by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.